Not 9 years, obviously. He only has 1 year left, but it's more than some people have, I suppose.
Who?
She asked, frowning at me.
Who has less years than that?
I thought about it. No one sprang to mind. His father only has 1 year too, I said. They have that in common, at least. The IRA shot one of them off a few months before the kidnapping.
They're a terrible shower, the IRA, she said. I hope you don't have anything to do with them, Cyril Avery.
I do not, I said, shaking my head quickly.
I don't have any interest in things like that.
I'm not political at all.
I suppose he walks with a limp, does he?
Who?
Julian. And him with only 9 toes. I suppose he walks with a limp.
I don't think so, I said, uncertain whether he did or not. If he does, I've never spotted it. To be honest, the only thing that really bothers him is the ear. Obviously his hearing is only half as good as it could be, and he looks a bit odd without it. But he grew his hair long, and it covers the right-hand side of his head, so no one really notices.
He still looks amazing.
Mary Margaret gave a little shudder.
The directors of the Bank of Ireland don't allow any of their male employees to wear their hair long, she said. And I don't blame them. Looks a bit too Nancy boy for me. And I prefer a man with 2 ears. 1 ear wouldn't be my standard at all.
I nodded and glanced around the cafe for the nearest fire exit, and to my horror caught the eye of a student priest sitting with 2 older priests, a few seats away from us, drinking a Coca-Cola and eating an Eccles cake. I recognized him from the back row of the Metropole Cinema, where I had sat next to him during a screening of A Man for All Seasons a few nights earlier. He'd placed his overcoat on his lap, and I'd given him a hand job in the dark. The smell of it after he came was only rancid, and people had started to turn around and stare at us. So we had no choice but to make a run for it just as Richard Rich was taking the stand to betray Thomas More. We both flushed red as we saw each other and turned away.
"What's the matter with you?"
asked Mary Margaret.
"All the blood has rushed to your face."
"I have a bit of a cold," I told her. "The fever comes and goes."
"Don't be giving me any of your germs," she said. "I don't want to come down with anything. I have my job to think of."
"I don't think it's catching," I said, taking a sip from my coffee. "I was very sorry to hear about Bridget, by the way," I told her. "You must have been very upset."
"Well,"
she said in a firm voice, putting her cup down and looking directly at me.
"Naturally, I was very sorry to hear that she had died, and the circumstances were, of course, appalling. But the truth is that I had cut my ties with her some time before."
"Oh, right," I said. "Did you have a falling out of some sort?"
"Let's just say that we were very different types."
She hesitated for a moment, but then seemed to throw caution to the wind.
"The truth is, Cyril, Bridget Simpson was a tarty piece, and I didn't care to be around that sort of element any more. I lost track of the number of men with whom she had relations. I said to her, 'Bridget,' I said, 'if you don't clean up your act, you'll meet a terrible end.' But she didn't listen to me. She said that life was for living and that I was too uptight." "Me? Uptight? Can you imagine it? Sure, I only live for a good laugh." "Anyway, it was when she started involving herself with married men that I said, 'Enough was enough.' I put my foot down and told her that I would have nothing more to do with her if she carried on with that sort of malarkey. The next thing I heard, she'd been killed in a car crash in Clonmel."
"I heard it was Clontarf," I said.
"Well, one of the Clons. I went to her funeral, of course, and lit a candle for her. I told her poor mother that she should take comfort in the fact that Bridget had taught us all a great lesson. That if you live a dissolute life, then you can expect to meet a horrible death."
"And how did she take that?"
"The poor woman was so grief-stricken she couldn't say a word. She just stared at me in shock. She probably blamed herself for bringing her daughter up without any sense of decency."
"Or maybe she thought you were being a little insensitive," I suggested.
"No, I don't think it was that at all," she said, appearing baffled by this remark. "Read your Bible, Cyril Avery. It's all in there."
We sat in silence for a few minutes, and I noticed the student priest standing up and making his way towards the doors, throwing an anxious look in my direction as he fled. For a moment I felt a certain sympathy for him, and, just as quickly, I felt it for myself, too. Then I wondered whether he was signalling that he was after the pictures, and if he was, how quickly I could escape Yuli's café and follow him.
"Can I ask you a question, Cyril?" asked Mary Margaret,
and I looked back at her, trying to stifle a yawn. I wondered why I hadn't just gone back to the office after the interview and avoided all of this.
"You can," I said. "Where do you go to Mass?"
"Where do I go to Mass?"
"Well, you have two ears on you anyway, even if your pal doesn't. Yes, where do you go to Mass?"
I opened my mouth in surprise, searched for an answer, couldn't find one, and so closed it again. The truth was that I never went to Mass. The last time I had been in the church was 7 years earlier, when I'd killed a priest by telling him all the perverted thoughts that went through my head.
"Mass," I repeated, hedging for time. "Are you a big Mass-goer yourself, then?"
"Of course I am," she said, frowning so hard that her forehead divided into five distinct lines, like the staff on a piece of sheet music.
"What do you take me for? I go to Baggot Street every day. They do a lovely Mass there. Have you ever been to the church on Baggot Street?"
"No," I said. "Not that I can recall."
"Oh, you must go sometime. There's a wonderful atmosphere to the place, for one thing. The scent of incense mixed with the smell of dead bodies is only breathtaking."
"Sounds lovely."
"It is. And Father gives a wonderful sermon. He's a real fire and brimstone type, which I think is just what Ireland needs right now. There's all sorts out there these days. I see them in the bank all the time. Students coming in from Trinity College wearing next to nothing, their hands in their backs of their boyfriend's denim jeans. You don't own any denim jeans, do you, Cyril?"
"I have one pair," I said. "But they're a bit long for me. I don't wear them very often."
"Throw them away. No man should be seen in a pair of denim jeans. Of course, I see the whole world from my position on the foreign exchange desk at the Bank of Ireland College Green. I had a divorced woman from England in last week, would you believe? I made my disapproval clear, I don't mind telling you. And there was a young man in only yesterday going around more like a girl than a boy. Oh, the way he spoke! He was one of those, of course," she added, bending her right hand to the wrist. "I refused to serve him. I told him he could go to the Allied Irish Bank if he wanted his money changed. They cater for that class of person there. He caused such a fuss.
Do you want to know what he called me?" "Not really," I said.
"B-I-T-C-H,"
she said, leaning forward and spelling the word out quietly.
She shook her head then and looked away. "I'm still not the better of it," she added after a moment. "Anyway, I asked the security guard to throw him out. And you know what he did then?"
"No," I said, "since I wasn't there."
"He started crying. He said his money was as good as anyone's, and he was sick of being treated like some second-class citizen. I told him that if I had my way, he wouldn't be a citizen at all. Of course, we all started laughing at him then, the customers too, and he sat down on one of the benches with a miserable look on his face, as if we were in the wrong. They should lock all the Nancy boys up, if you ask me. Put them out on one of the islands off the west coast, where they can do no harm to anyone but each other. But anyway, Cyril, what are we talking about? Oh, yes. Where do you go to Mass?"
"Westland Row," I told her, for want of a better answer. It was hard enough to keep up with her list of prejudices without trying to think of a Dublin church of which she might approve.
"Oh, that's a beautiful building," she said,
surprising me by not dismissing it for being too tall, too wide, or having too many letters in its name.
"A lovely bit of stonework in there. It's on my list every year on Holy Thursday when I do my visita iglesia. I wonder if I've ever seen you in there."
"Anything is possible," I said. "But most things are unlikely."
"And tell me this and tell me no more," she added, taking another sip from her tea and pulling a face.
It seemed that even the tea was conspiring against her now.
"What do you do with yourself?"
"I'm sorry?"
"I'm assuming that you have a good job somewhere."
"Oh, right, yes," I said, telling her about my work at the Department of Education, and her eyes lit up immediately. "Now, that's a great career to have," she said. "Almost as good as working in a bank. You simply can't go wrong with the civil service. They can't fire you for one thing, even if times are hard and you're completely incompetent. Daddy always wanted me to join the civil service, but I said, 'Daddy, I'm an independent young woman and I'll find my own position.' And find it I did on the foreign exchange desk at the Bank of Ireland College Green. But I always think the great thing about the civil service is that you can go in there 20 years old, spend every day of your life behind one desk, and before you know it, you're an old man and it's all behind you, and the only thing left to do is die. There must be great security in that." "I hadn't really thought about it that way," I said, feeling a curious mélange of mortality and misery at the idea. "But I suppose you're right."
"Did I ever tell you that my Uncle Martin was a civil servant?"
"Well, no," I said. "But then we've only just met again."
"He was a wonderful civil servant, and a lovely man. Although he had a twitch in his cheek, and I don't like a man with a twitch, it makes me uncomfortable."
"Does he still work there?" I asked. "Maybe I might know him."
"No," she said, tapping her temple. "He got the dementia," she told me, lowering her voice almost to a whisper. "He can't remember who he is half the time. The last time I saw him, he thought I was Dorothy L'Amour."
She barked a laugh and looked around, shaking her head in delight before her face turned stony with disgust once again.
"Would you take a look at her?" she said.
I turned to glance in the direction in which she was staring and saw a young girl making her way down the centre aisle of Bewley's. A young stunner who was defying the weather by wearing as few clothes as possible. The eyes of every man in the place were on her behind as she passed. Almost every man, anyway.
"Mutton dressed as lamb," said Mary Margaret, curling her lip. "That wouldn't be my standard now at all."
"Would you like a cream cake to go with your tea?" I asked.
"No, thank you, Cyril. Cream doesn't agree with me."
"Right." I checked my watch and saw that we had already been in the cafe for 7 minutes, which I thought was long enough. "Well, I suppose I better be getting back," I said.
"Getting back where?"
"Back to work," I said.
"Oh, listen to you," she said, "Mr. Heishy-tighy."
I had no idea what she meant by this. It didn't seem like such a bizarre idea that I should return to work, since it was only 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
"It was nice to see you again, Mary Margaret," I said, extending my hand. "Hold on there now, you, till I give you my phone number," she said, reaching into her bag for a pen and paper.
"Why?" I asked.
"But sure, how else would you be able to call me if you didn't know what my number was?"
I frowned, uncertain what she was getting at.
"I'm sorry," I said. "Did you want me to call you?
Was there something you needed to ask me? Because I can stay a little longer if there is."
"No. We'll have something to talk about for next time."
She scribbled down a number and handed it across to me.
"It'll be better if you call me than the other way around. I wouldn't be the type to phone a boy. But I won't be waiting by the telephone for you either, so don't get any notions on that score. And if Daddy answers, tell him that you're a civil servant from the Department of Education. Because he'll approve of that. Otherwise, he'll give you a short shrift."
I stared at the piece of paper in my hand and didn't know what to say. This was entirely outside of my realm of experience.
"Call me on Saturday afternoon," she said, "and we'll make plans for Saturday night."
"All right," I said, uncertain what I was getting myself into, but confident that I had no choice in the matter.
"There's a picture that I want to see," she told me. "It's playing in the Metropole. A Man for All Seasons."
"I've seen that one," I said, not adding that I'd had to leave just as Richard Rich was betraying his mentor for Wales because I needed to wash the smell of a jacket off my hands.
"Well, I haven't," she said, "and I want to."
"There's lots of other pictures on," I said. "I'll have a look in the paper later and see what's what."
"I want to see A Man for All Seasons," she insisted, leaning forward and glaring at me.
"Right so," I said, standing up before she could pick up a knife and do to me what the IRA had done to Julian.
I'll call you on Saturday, so. At 4 o'clock. Not a minute earlier.
4 o'clock, I said, turning around and making my way out of the cafe, the perspiration already starting to cause my shirt to stick to my back. Walking back to work in the sunshine, I considered the situation. Without ever having intended to, and without even wanting such a thing, it seemed that I had a girlfriend. And my girlfriend was Mary Margaret Muffet. Apparently, I was her standard. On one hand, the idea terrified me, for I had no knowledge of how to behave with a girl, and even less interest in finding out. But on the other, this was a great development in my life, for it meant that there was a chance I could be just like everyone else, and no one would be suspicious of me. And thank God I wouldn't have to join a seminary, which I'd been vaguely considering as an answer to all my problems for about a year now. Back in the office, I ignored an endless conversation that my colleagues were having about Jacqueline Kennedy and sat down to write a long letter to Julian, telling him that I'd fallen in love with a beautiful girl I'd met in Bewley's Cafe. I described her in the most complimentary way I could, and implied that we'd been having relations every which way for the last few months. I did everything I could to sound as sexually promiscuous as him, and signed off by saying that the only problem with having a girlfriend was not being able to take advantage of all the other girls that were out there. I couldn't do that, I told him. I love her too much. Still, I added, just because I'm on a diet doesn't mean I can't take a look at the menu. I sent the letter care of the Western Union office in Salzburg, where he and that Susie Harpy had gone skiing, and hoped that his curiosity might bring him back to Dublin soon, so we could go on double dates together, and then maybe the girls would strike up a friendship and tell us to go out for drinks on our own, so they could talk about knitting and recipes and so on, and it would just be Julian and me left alone together, like it was supposed to be. With a few weeks, Mary Margaret and I were an established couple, and every Sunday she gave me a list of the things we would be doing during the week ahead. I had Tuesdays and Thursdays off, but had to be with her every other evening, most of which was spent sitting together on the sofa in her front room while her daddy watched television and ate chocolate-covered Brazil nuts, all the time proclaiming that he was sick of chocolate-covered Brazil nuts. After about a month, it occurred to me that nothing sexual had occurred between us yet, and decided that it might be worth a try. After all, I had never enjoyed any intimacy with a girl, and there was always the possibility that if I tried it, I might actually enjoy it. And so, after her daddy went up to bed one night, I leaned over and, without any warning, pressed my lips against hers.
"Excuse me," she said,
rearing back on the sofa with an appalled expression on her face.
"What do you think you're doing, Cyril Avery?"
"I was trying to kiss you," I said.
She shook her head slowly and looked at me as if I just admitted that I was Jack the Ripper or a member of the Labour Party.
"I thought you had a little bit more respect for me than that," she said. "I had no idea that all this time I was going out with a sex pervert."
"I don't think that's quite accurate," I said.
"Well, how else would you describe yourself? Here I am, trying to watch Perry Mason, let alone that all the time you were planning on raping me."
"I wasn't planning anything of the sort," I protested. "It was just a kiss, that's all."
"Shouldn't we be kissing if we're doing a line together? There's nothing wrong with that, Mary Margaret, is there?"
"Well, maybe," she said, considering it. "But you could at least have the decency to ask in future. There's nothing less romantic than spontaneity."
"All right," I said. "Well, can I kiss you then?" She thought about it, and finally nodded her head.
"You can," she said. "But make sure to keep your eyes closed, and your mouth too. And I don't want your hands anywhere near me. I can't stand to be touched."
I did as instructed, pressing my lips against hers again, and mumbling her name as if I was lost in the passion of a great love affair. She remained rigid on the sofa, and I could tell that she was still watching the television, where Perry Mason was getting tough with the man in the witness box. After about 30 seconds of this uncontrollable eroticism, I pulled away.
"You're a great kisser," I told her.
"I hope you're not suggesting that I have a past,"
she said.
No, I only meant that you have very nice lips. She narrowed her eyes, uncertain whether that too might be the sort of thing a sex pervert would say.
Well, that'll be enough for one night, she said. We don't want to get carried away, do we?
Fair enough. I glanced down at the crotch of my pants. There had been no movement whatsoever. If anything, there had been what could only be called a great shriveling.
And don't think that one thing will lead to another, Cyril Avery, she warned me. I know there are girls out there who will do anything to hold on to a man, but that's not my standard. That's not my standard at all.
No problem, I said, meaning every word of it.
Everywhere, people stare. It was a difficult time to be Irish, a difficult time to be 21 years of age, and a difficult time to be a man who was attracted to other men. To be all three simultaneously required a level of subterfuge and guile that felt contrary to my nature. I had never considered myself to be a dishonest person, hating the idea that I was capable of such mendacity and deceit, but the more I examined the architecture of my life, the more I realized how fraudulent were its foundations. The belief that I would spend the rest of my time on earth lying to people weighed heavily on me, and at such times I gave serious consideration to taking my own life. Knives frightened me, nooses horrified me, and guns alarmed me. But I knew that I was not a strong swimmer. Were I to head out to Howth, for example, and throw myself into the sea, the current would quickly pull me under, and there would be nothing I could do to save myself. It was an option that was always at the back of my mind. I had few friends, and even when I considered my relationship with Julian, I had to admit that our bond was built on little more than my obsessive and undeclared love. I had guarded and nurtured that alliance jealously over the years, ignoring the fact that were it not for my determination to stay in touch, he might have moved on years ago. I had no family to speak of, no siblings, no cousins, no idea as to the identities of my birth parents. I had very little money, and had grown to hate the flat on Chatham Street, for Albert Thatcher had acquired a serious girlfriend, and when she stayed over, the sound of their lovemaking was as ghastly as it was arousing. I longed for a place of my own, a door with only one key. In desperation, I turned to Charles, asking for a loan of £100 so that I could set myself up in a better situation. I had seen a flat above a shop on Nassau Street with a view over the lawns of Trinity College, but I could never have afforded it on the pitiful salary that I earned. The loan, I told him, would allow me to live there for 2 years while I saved money and tried to build a better life for myself. We were sitting in the yacht club at Dunleary when I broached the idea, eating lobster and drinking Moët and Chandon, but he refused me instantly, declaring that he didn't loan money to friends, as such acts of philanthropy always ended badly. "But we're more than friends, surely," I said, throwing myself on his mercy. "You're my adoptive father, after all."
"Oh, come along, Cyril," he replied,
laughing as if I was making a joke.
"You're 25 years old now."
"I'm 21.
21, then. Naturally, I care about you. We've known each other a long time, but you're not..."
"I know," I said, holding up a hand before he could finish that sentence. "It doesn't matter." Of most concern to me, however, was my overwhelming, insatiable and uncontrollable lust, a yearning that was as intense as my need for food and water, but that, unlike those other basic human needs, was always countered by the fear of discovery. There were nighttime excursions to the banks of the Grand Canal, or the clustered forests at the heart of the Phoenix Park, furtive explorations of the narrow laneways off Baggot Street, and the hidden passages that zigzagged from the Happeny Bridge towards Christchurch Cathedral. The darkness concealed my crimes, but convinced me that I was a degenerate, a pervert, a Mr. Hyde, who left my benevolent Dr. Jekyll's skin behind on Chatham Street as soon as the sun went down and the clouds passed slowly to cover the moon. Satisfying my lust was not the problem. In the city centre it wasn't difficult to find a young man with similar predilections, and a simple exchange of looks could create an instant contract as we made our way wordlessly to a hiding place with little chance of discovery, fumbling behind bushes, careful not to look into each other's eyes as our hands pulled and caressed, while our lips moved hungrily as we stood with our backs against trees, lay together on the grass, or knelt before each other in attitudes of supplication. We would paw at each other's bodies until one of us could take no more, then gush forth into the earth beneath our feet, and although the urge was always to leave as quickly as possible afterwards, good etiquette meant that you could not go until the other boy had reached his climax too. A quick thank you would be followed by our turning in opposite directions and walking quickly away, making for home with a silent prayer that the Gardaí were not following us, as we swore on our heads that this was the last time, that we would never do such a thing again, that we were done with it forever. But then the hours would pass, the urges would return, and by the following night our curtains would be twitching as we looked outside to see what the weather was like. I didn't like going to the parks, because they were usually populated by older men with cars looking for someone young to fuck in the back seat, the stench of their Guinness and sweat enough to sublimate any desire that I might feel. But I went when I was desperate, fearing for the day when I too might find myself driving past Arasanukdaron in search of young skin. I stopped going when the old men began to offer me money. They would pull up next to me, and if I refused them, would say that there was a pound note in it for me if I did what I was asked. And once or twice, when times were hard, I accepted their pound, but sex without desire was not something that turned me on. I could not commit the act for money. I needed to want it. Only once did I dare to bring someone home to Chatham Street, and that was because I was drunk, dizzy with lust, and the boy I had met, a few years older than me, at 23 or 24, put me so much in mind of Julian that I thought I could spend a night with him and imagine that my friend had somehow succumbed to my desires. The boy's name was Ciarán, or at least that was the name he gave me, and we met in a downstairs bar off Harcourt Street, a place whose blacked-out windows encouraged its clientele to feel that they, like the Beatles, had to hide their love away. I went there occasionally, for it was a good place to meet someone as shy and anxious as me under cover of simply stopping in for a pint. I saw him as he returned from the bathroom, and we exchanged a look of mutual appreciation. A few minutes later, he came over to ask whether he could join me. "Of course," I said, nodding towards the empty chair. "I'm on my own." "Sure, we're all on our own," he replied with a wry smile. "What's your name, anyway?"
"Julian,"
I said, the name out of my mouth before I could even consider the wisdom of the choice. "And you?"
"Ciarán."
I nodded and took a drink from my Smithwick's, trying not to stare at him too intensely. He was ridiculously handsome, much better looking than the type I normally ended up with. And, of course, it was he who had made the decision to approach me, which meant that he was interested. We said nothing for a while. I racked my brain for some sensible conversation starter, but my mind was a blank, and I was relieved when he took the lead.
"I've never been here before," he said, looking around. And the familiar way in which he nodded at the barman made me know that this wasn't true. "I heard it was a bit of crack."
"Me neither,"
I said.
"I was just passing by and stopped in for a drink. I didn't even know there was a bar here." "Do you mind if I ask what you do?"
he asked.
"I work in Dublin Zoo," I told him,
which was my standard reply to this question.
"In the reptile house."
"I'm frightened of spiders," said Ciarán.
"Actually, spiders are arachnids," I said, as if I knew what I was talking about. "Reptiles are lizards and iguanas and so on."
"All right," he said.
I glanced behind him to where an old man, his belly hanging over the belt of his trousers, was sitting at the bar looking longingly in our direction. I could tell from his expression that he wished he could join us, that he had some natural place in our company. But we were 40 years younger than him, so of course he didn't, and he stayed where he was, perhaps contemplating the random unkindness of the universe.
"I'll probably not stay long," said Ciarán eventually. "Nor me," I said. "I have work in the morning."
"Do you live nearby?"
I hesitated, having never brought anyone home to Chatham Street. But this was different. He was just too good to let go of. And then there was the Julian look-alike thing. I knew I wanted more than some illicit fumble in an alleyway that stank of piss and chips in the previous night's washed-away vomit. I wanted to know what it would be like to hold him, to really hold him, and to be held by him, to be really held. "Not too far," I said slowly. "Near Grafton Street. But it's a bit difficult there. What about you?"
"Not possible, I'm afraid," he said.
It occurred to me how quickly we understood each other, how little discussion it took to make it clear that we wanted to go to bed with each other. For all they said, I was sure that the heterosexual lads would have loved it if women had behaved like us. "Well, maybe we could take a walk," I said, willing to settle for the usual if that was all that was on offer. "It's not a bad night out." He considered this only briefly before shaking his head.
"Sorry," he said,
placing a hand on my knee beneath the table, which set off sparks of electricity around my body. "I'm not really the outdoors type, to be honest."
"Sure, never mind. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Am I right? Another time, perhaps?"
He stood up, and I knew that I was on the verge of losing him, and made a quick decision. "We could try mine," I said, "but we'd have to be quiet."
"Are you sure?"
he asked, looking hopeful. "We'd have to be very quiet," I repeated. "I have a flatmate, and the landlady and her son live downstairs. I don't know what would happen if they found us." "I can be quiet," he said. "Or I can try to be, anyway," he added with a smile, which made me laugh, despite my unease. We left the bar and made our way back towards St. Stephen's Green. There were any number of good reasons not to allow him to cross the threshold, but none was strong enough to fight the fact that every atom in my body longed for his, and soon enough we were standing outside the bright red door where there was nothing left to do but slide the key into the lock. In my anxiety, I struggled to insert it correctly. "Just wait here a minute," I whispered, leaning so close to him that our lips were almost touching. "Let me see whether the coast is clear." The lights were out in the hallway, and the door to Albert's room was closed, which meant that he was probably asleep. I turned back and waved Ciarán inside, and we made our way upstairs. When I opened my own door, I pushed him inside, locked it behind us, and within a minute we were on the bed, tearing at each other's clothes like a pair of teenagers, and all notions of being quiet went out of my head as we did what we'd come here to do, what we had been born to do. It was an entirely new experience to me. Usually the temptation was to get it over with as quickly as possible and run away, but for once I wanted to take things slowly. I had never had sex in a bed before, and the sensation of the sheets against my bare skin was incredibly arousing. I had never run my hands along a man's leg, never felt the ripple of the hairs beneath my palm, never known what it was like for my bare feet to touch his, or to turn him over and run my tongue along his spinal cord as his back arched in pleasure. In the dull light that trickled through the curtains from the street lamp outside, we felt the sincerity of what we were doing, and soon I forgot about Julian altogether and thought only of Ciarán. As night turned towards morning, I felt something that I had never felt during sex before. Something more than lust or the frantic urgency of an orgasm. I felt warmth and friendship and happiness. And all this for a stranger. All this for a man whose real name I probably didn't even know. Finally, he turned to me and smiled, shaking his head with that familiar expression of regret. "I better go," he said. "You could stay," I suggested, surprised to hear such words emerge from my mouth. "You could leave when my flatmate is having his bath in the morning. No one would know." "I can't," he said, climbing out of bed, and I watched as he reached for his clothes, which were scattered among my own on the floor. "My wife will be expecting me back soon. She thinks I'm on a night shift. My heart sank inside my chest, and I realized that I had felt the gold band on his left hand against my back as he had held me and thought nothing of it. He was married. Of course he was. And as he buttoned his shirt and searched for his shoes, I saw that the revelation meant nothing to him.
"Have you lived here long?"
he asked as he dressed, for silence was worse than anything.
"A while," I said.
"It's nice enough," he said, before stopping and looking around the walls.
"Is it just me, or does this crack look like the journey the River Shannon takes through the Midlands?"
"That's what I've always thought," I said. "I've asked the landlady to fix it, but she says that it will cost too much, and it's been there forever, so no harm." I lay back down, pulling the sheets up to my neck to cover my nakedness, and wanted him to stop talking and just leave.
"Listen, we could do this again sometime, if you like," he suggested as he made his way towards the door.
"I can't," I said, repeating his own phrase. "Sorry."
"No problem,"
he replied with a shrug. It had been nothing more than a fuck for him, one of many, probably. There would be another tomorrow night, and another at the weekend, and another during the week after that. A moment later, he was gone, and a part of me didn't care if Albert, Mrs. Hogan, or her blind son opened their doors to find him leaving. But there was no uproar from downstairs, and it seemed that he had escaped without notice.
There are no homosexuals in Ireland.
A few days later, I made an appointment with a doctor. His name was Dr. Dourish, his practice located in a row of red-bricked houses in Dundrum, a part of the city that I did not know well. There were a number of doctors that had some association with the civil service, and from whom we could receive favourable rates, but not trusting the rules of their profession within Catholic Ireland, I was nervous of exposing myself, either literally or metaphorically, to anyone who might reveal my secret to my employers. I had hoped that he might be young and sympathetic towards my situation, and was disappointed to find that he was well into his 60s, close to retirement age, and looked about as friendly as a teenage boy woken for school on Monday morning. He smoked a pipe throughout our consultation, picking tiny shreds of tobacco from his yellow teeth that he deposited in an ashtray on the desk that he did not seem to have emptied in some time. A St. Bridget's cross on the wall made my heart sink a little, not to mention the statue of the Sacred Heart behind his desk containing a flickering bulb that gave it a rather ghostly aspect.
"Mr. Sadler, is that right?"
he asked, picking up the file his secretary had given him and for which, naturally, I had provided a false name. "That's right," I said. "Tristan Sadler. That's my name. Always has been since the day I was born."
"And what can I do for you today?"
I looked away, glancing towards the bed that stood against one of the walls, and on which I wished that I could lie, like a psychiatric patient, while he stood behind me. I wanted to recount my woes without having to see the expression on his face, the inevitable disgust.
"Do you think I could lie down?" I asked.
"Why?"
"I prefer it."
"No,"
he said, shaking his head.
"That's not for patients. It's where I have my afternoon nap."
"Right. I'll stay where I am, so."
"If you would."
"I wanted to talk to you," I said. "I think there's something wrong with me."
"Well, of course there's something wrong with you, sir. Why else would you be here?"
"What is it?"
"It's a little delicate."
"Ah,"
he said, smiling a little and nodding his head.
"Do you mind if I ask how old you are, Tristan?"
"I'm 21.
"Would it be a matter of an intimate nature?"
"Yes."
"I guessed as much," he said. "You've caught something, am I right? The women in this city have gone to hell, if you ask me. Dirty little pups, all of them. You should never have given them the vote, if you ask me. Gave them ideas."
"No,"
I replied.
I had, of course, caught one or two things in recent times, but I had another doctor, one on the north side, that I used during these moments, and he always prescribed me something that sorted the problem out quickly.
No, it's nothing like that.
All right, then,
he said with a sigh.
So, what is it, then? Spit it out, man.
I think... the thing is, Doctor, I haven't quite developed in the way that I'm supposed to.
I don't follow you.
I suppose I mean that I'm not as interested in girls as I should be, as other lads my age are.
I see,
he said, his smile fading now.
Well, that's not as abnormal as you might think either. Some boys are late developers. Is it not a big priority for you, then? The old sex, I mean.
It's a very big priority, I told him. It's probably my biggest priority. I think about it all day long, from the minute I wake up in the morning until the minute I go to bed. And then I dream about it. Sometimes I even have dreams where I go to bed, and I have dreams in my dreams about it.
Then what's the problem?
He asked. And I could tell that he was growing frustrated by my obfuscation.
Can you not get a girlfriend, is that it? You're not a bad-looking fella. I'm sure there's lots of girls who'd be happy to do a line with you. Are you shy? Is that it? Do you not know how to talk to them?
I'm not shy, I said, finding my voice now and determined to get it out and damn the consequences. And as it happens, I have a girlfriend, thank you very much, but I don't really want one, is the thing. It's not girls that I think about, you see. It's boys.
There was a long silence, during which I didn't dare to look up at him, focusing instead on the carpet beneath my feet, and where it had worn thin from the amount of people who had sat in that same seat over the years, dragging their shoes back and forth in anxiety, grief, or depression. The silence continued for so long that I feared Dr. Dourish had died of shock, and that I had another corpse on my conscience.
Finally, however, I heard him push his seat back, and I glanced up as he walked over to a cabinet, unlocked it, and removed a small packet from the top shelf. He closed the door again, relocked it, and sat down, placing the mysterious package on the desk between us.
First, said Dr. Dourish, you mustn't think that you're alone in your affliction. There have been plenty of boys who have had similar feelings over the years, from the ancient Greeks to the present day. Perverts, degenerates, and sickos have existed since the dawn of time, so don't for a minute think that you're anything special. There are even some places where you can get away with it, and no one bats an eyelid. But the important thing for you to remember, Tristan, is that you must never act on these disgusting urges. You're a good, decent Irish Catholic boy, and you are a Catholic, aren't you?
Yes, I said, even though I had no allegiance to any religion.
But, lad, well, unfortunately you have been cursed with a terrible sickness, something that falls on random people for no apparent reason. But you must not think for a moment that you are a homosexual, because you aren't.
I flushed a little at the utterance of that dreaded and prescribed word, which was almost never spoken in polite society.
Yes, it's true, he continued, that there are homosexuals all over the world. England has lots of them. France is full of them. And I've never been to America, but I imagine they have more than their share, too. I wouldn't think it's all that common in Russia or Australia, but they probably have some other repulsive thing to compensate. But here's what you have to remember. There are no homosexuals in Ireland. You might have got it into your head that you are one, but you're just wrong. And it's as simple as that. You're wrong.
It doesn't feel as simple as that, Doctor, I said carefully. I really think that I might be.
But why are you not listening to me?
He asked, smiling at me as if I was a complete ignoramus.
How was I after telling you that there are no homosexuals in Ireland? And if there are no homosexuals in Ireland, then how on earth could you be one?
I thought about it, trying my best to locate the logic in his argument.
Now, he continued, what makes you think that you're one of them anyway? A dirty queer, I mean.
It's pretty simple, I said. I'm both physically and sexually attracted to men.
Well, sure, that doesn't make you homosexual, he said,
opening his hands wide in a gesture of acceptance. Doesn't it? I asked, a little baffled by this. I thought it did.
Not at all, not at all, he said, shaking his head. You've just been watching too much television, that's all.
But I don't own a television, I said.
To go to the pictures?
I do.
How often?
Once a week, usually.
Well, that'll do it. What was the last picture you saw?
Alfie.
I don't know that one.
Was it any good? I liked it, I said. Mary Margaret said it was disgusting and that Michael Caine ought to be ashamed of himself. She said he was a filthy article with no respect for himself.
What was Mary Margaret?
My girlfriend. He burst out laughing again and sat forward, refilling his pipe and lighting it with a series of stop-start puffs as the tobacco flamed from red to black and back again.
Would you listen to yourself, Tristan? He said.
If you have a girlfriend, then you're definitely not a homosexual.
But I don't like my girlfriend, I pointed out. She's judgmental and critical of everything and everyone. She's always telling me what to do and orders me about like I'm a dog. And I never look at her and think she's pretty. I can't even imagine wanting to see her with her clothes off. Whenever I kiss her, I feel like throwing up afterwards. And sometimes I look at her and just wish she'd meet someone else and drop me so I wouldn't have to be the one to do it. Also, she has this weird smell. She says washing too often is a sign of pride.
But sure, we all feel that way about the women, said Dr. Durish with a shrug.
I've lost track of the number of times I've wanted to slip something into Mrs. Durish's hot chocolate at night so that she wouldn't wake up in the morning. And I have access to everything I'd need, too. I could write a prescription for poison, and there's not a jury in the land would question it. But that doesn't make me a homosexual, does it? How could it be? I love Judy Garland and Joan Crawford and Betty Davis. I never miss any of their pictures.
I just wanted to stop, I said, raising my voice in frustration. I want to stop thinking about men and be just like everyone else.
Which is why you came to see me, he replied. And I'm glad to say that you've come to the right place because I can help you.
My heart lifted a little, and I looked across at him hopefully. Really? I asked.
Oh, yes, he said,
nodding his head in the direction of the small package he'd placed on the desk between us.
Pick that up like a good man and open it.
I did as instructed, and a small syringe with a long, pointed needle about the size of my index finger fell out.
Do you know what that is?
Asked Dr. Durish. I do, I said. It's a syringe.
Good lad. Now, I want you to trust me, all right? Give the syringe to me.
I handed it across, and he nodded towards the bed.
Go over there. And sit on the edge.
I thought that wasn't for patients.
I make an exception for degenerates. And take your trousers off first.
I felt anxious about what was going to happen next, but did as I was told, letting my trousers fall around my ankles and sitting where he'd told me. Dr. Durish approached me, holding the syringe in his right hand in a rather threatening way.
Now take your underpants off, he said.
I'd rather not, I said.
Do as you're told, he said, or I won't be able to help you.
I hesitated, embarrassed and nervous, but finally did as instructed and tried not to look at him as I sat there, naked from the waist down.
Now, said the doctor, I'm going to call out some names to you, and I want you to react to them in whatever way feels natural to you, all right?
All right, I said.
Bing Crosby, he said,
and I didn't move, just looked at the wall ahead, thinking of the night I'd gone to see a re-release of High Society with Mary Margaret in the Adelphi Cinema on Abbey Street. She'd been disgusted by the whole thing,
asking what kind of dirty tramp would divorce one man for another and then go back to the first one on the day of her second wedding. It showed a lack of moral conviction, she claimed, which was not her standard at all.
"Richard Nixon," said Dr. Dourish then,
and I grimaced. There was talk that Nixon was going to be running for president again in 1968, and I hoped that he wouldn't. There was something about seeing that face in the newspapers every morning that put me off my breakfast.
"Warren Beatty," he said,
and this time my face lit up. I had loved Warren Beatty ever since I'd seen him opposite Natalie Wood in Splendor in the Grass a few years earlier, and had been first in line for Promise or Anything when it had opened in the Carlton the year before. Before I could contemplate his beauty any further, however, I found myself leaping off the bed in unexpected agony, tripping over my feet as my trousers conspired to take me down, and I fell to the floor writhing in agony and clutching my groin. When I finally dared to take my hands away, there was a tiny red mark on my scrotum that had not been there 5 minutes earlier. "You stabbed me!" I cried out, looking across at Dr. Dourish as if he was insane. "You stabbed me in the balls with your syringe!"
"I did indeed," he said,
bowing a little as if he was accepting words of gratitude.
"Now, get up here, Tristan, so I can do it again."
"I'll do no such thing," I said, struggling to my feet and weighing up whether I should punch him in the face or just make a run for it. I must have been a comical sight standing there in the middle of his surgery, with my cock hanging out, my trousers hanging off me, and my face red with fury.
"You want to be cured, don't you?"
he asked in a benevolent, avuncular tone, ignoring my obvious distress. "I do, yes," I said. "But not like this. It hurts."
"But this is the only way," he said. "We will train your brain to associate feelings of lust towards men with the most intense pain. That way you will not allow yourself to feel these disgusting thoughts. Think of Pavlov's dog. It's a similar principle."
"I don't know Pavlov, and I don't know his dog," I said. "But unless either of them has been stabbed in the balls with a syringe, I don't think they can have any idea what I'm feeling right now."
"Fine," said Dr. Dourish with a shrug. "Continue with your sordid fantasies. Live a life that is dominated by disgusting and immoral thoughts. Be an outcast from society for the rest of your days. It's your choice. But remember, you came here for help, and I am offering help. It's up to you whether or not to accept it."
I thought about this, and as the pain subsided, I slowly, very, very slowly, made my way back towards the bed and sat down, trembling and close to tears. I grabbed the side of the bed and closed my eyes.
"Very good," he said. "Now let's try again. Paul the Sixth."
"Nothing."
"Charles Lawton."
"Nothing."
"George Harrison."
"And if there were any patients awaiting their turn outside, I dare say they turned on their heels and ran when they heard the sounds of my screams piercing the plasterwork and threatening to tear down the walls. When I stumbled out, half an hour later, barely able to walk, and with tears rolling down my cheeks, the surgery was empty except for Dr. Dourish's secretary, who was seated behind her desk, writing a receipt. "That'll be 15 pence, she said, handing the docket across. And I reached carefully, very, very carefully, into my pocket for the money. Before I could retrieve it, however, the door to the doctor's office opened, and, worried that he was going to come at me, crying, "Harold Macmillan! Adolf Hitler! Tony Curtis!" I wondered whether I should make a run for it.
"An extra 3 pence for a syringe, Annie," said Dr. Dourish. "Mr. Sadler is taking one with him."
18 pence, then," she said. And I put the money on the table and limped out, glad to breathe the fresh air of Dundrum. Making my way down the street towards the shopping centre, I stopped at a bench and sat down, adjusting myself to find a comfortable position, and put my head in my hands. A young couple, the wife showing early signs of pregnancy, stopped when they saw me and asked whether I was all right, whether there was anything they could do for me. "I'm fine," I said. "Thank you, though." "You don't look all right," said the woman. "That's because I'm not."
I've just had a man stab a needle into my scrotum about 20 times over the course of an hour, and it hurts like hell.
I'd imagine it would, said the man nonchalantly. I hope you didn't pay for that kind of treatment.
I paid 18 pence, I said.
You could get a good night out on that if you were careful, said the woman.
Do you need a doctor?
There's one down the road if... It was the doctor who did it, I said. I just need a taxi, that's all. I want to go home. Helen, said the man, keep an eye out for a taxi. The poor man can hardly stand. And no sooner had she turned around and raised her hand in the air than one came our way and pulled in.
Nothing is worth this kind of upset, said the woman as I climbed into the back seat.
She had a kindly face, and there was a part of me that wanted to weep on her shoulder and tell her all my woes.
Whatever's wrong with you, don't worry. It'll all come good in the end.
I wish I had your confidence, I said, closing the door as the car pulled away.
Before the whole car could go up in flames. A few weeks later, the minister was caught with his pants down. A supposedly happily married man who dragged his wife and children to Mass with him every Sunday morning, he could usually be found standing in the church grounds afterwards, regardless of the weather, shaking hands with his constituents and promising to see them all at the GAA match the following weekend. A country TD, he'd stayed in his Dublin flat at the weekend, only to be discovered in the early hours of Sunday morning being sucked off in his car by a 16-year-old drug addict who had only been released from serving 6 months for public order offences in the Finglas Child and Adolescent Centre earlier that day. The minister was arrested and brought to Pier Street Garda Station, where he refused to give his name and did the usual routine of demanding all their badge numbers, insisting that none of them would have a job by the end of the day. When he tried to leave, he was bundled into a cell and left to stew. It only took about an hour for someone to identify him. A junior garda, tasked with bringing cups of tea to the residence of the drunk tank, took one look at the minister's fat, sweaty face, recognised him from the evening news, and went outside to inform his sergeant who, no fan of the government of the day, made a couple of discreet phone calls to a journalist friend of his. By the time he had been processed, bailed and released, the scrum had formed outside, and he emerged into the daylight to a barrage of questions, accusations, and the endless click-clack of camera shutters. When I arrived at the department the following morning, the media were parked outside on Marlborough Street, and I made my way up to the office to find Miss Joyce, Miss Ambrosia, and Mr. Denby at the heart of the drama.
"There you are, Mr. Avery," said Miss Joyce as I put my bag down. "What kept you until this time?"
"It's only just gone 9, I said, glancing over the clock. "Why, what's happened?"
"Have you not heard?"
I shook my head, and Miss Joyce did her best to explain, using every euphemism known to man to avoid saying the necessary words. But the more flustered she grew, the less sense she made, and finally Mr. Denby threw his hands in the air in frustration and stepped in to make things clear.
"The garda knocked on the window of his car," he said,
raising his voice so there could be no confusion over what had taken place,
"and found the pair of them inside with their trousers around their ankles and the boy with the minister's cock in his mouth. There'd be no way out of this one for him. It's going to make a hell of a splash. No pun intended."
I opened my mouth wide in a mixture of disbelief and amusement, and perhaps it was unfortunate that it was still open in the shape of an O when the minister himself walked in, pale, perspiring, and petulant. He pointed a finger at me and let out a roar.
"Yo," he said, "what's your name again?"
"Avery," I told him. "Cyril Avery."
"Are you trying to be funny, Avery?"
"No," I said. "Sorry, sir."
"Because I'll tell you this. I've had enough jokes for one morning, and I'm likely to punch the nose off the next man who makes any kind of crack. Do you understand me?"
"Yes, sir," I said, looking down at my shoes and trying not to laugh.
"Miss Joyce," he said, turning to our supposed leader, "where are we on this now? Have you put anything out yet? We have to get in front of this thing before it spirals out of control."
"I have drafted something," she said, reaching for a piece of paper on her desk, "but I wasn't sure what line you wanted to take, and Miss Ambrosia has finished your wife's statement."
"Read it to me," he said.
Miss Ambrosia stood up and cleared her throat, as if she was preparing for an audition, and read aloud from her notebook. "The minister and I have been married for more than 30 years, and in all that time I have never had any occasion to question his loyalty, his deeply felt Catholicism, or his abiding love for women. The minister has always been enthralled to the female.